Every lap in under a minute. Every move made to matter. Every decision impacting the outcome of the race. Supercars in Perth. Every second matters. Bosch Power Tools Perth Super Sprint, May 17 to 19. Book now at Ticketek. Supercars. Unforgettable.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
A Motorsport Podcast Network production.
Hey everyone, welcome along. It is the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Castrol in 2024. And we thought it was time to empty the mailbag because I tell you what, in the last few weeks while I've been off chatting to Phil Keed and to Garth Tander, the mailbox, it's full. We have to empty it out. So we thought it's time for another Q&A episode. I can't do them on my own because there's so much mail. Will Dale is with me. Hello, Will.
Hello.
We've got a bit to get through here.
We do. We've got quite a few fun questions to get through here. A few stats things, a few history things, and a few opinion things.
No food questions this week?
There were a couple, but they didn't make it in.
Not quite making the cut.
Actually, no. Corey Stade asked, how do we feel about pork crackling?
I'm okay about it, but it's not a big thing I would go searching for.
Yeah, same. I'm doing my heritage a disservice by not being a huge fan of pork. I think the Filipino community will be after me, but here we are.
That's okay. Hey, let's get into it. Kenny Martin with the first question, new ball from the Sleuth end. He stumbled across a motoring magazine. Funnily enough, we do a bit of that too. From 1988 recently. How old were you in 88?
Single digits. I reckon I would have been two or three, depending on when.
Depending on year. I think it was seven. There was an article there about a 24-hour touring car race at Bathurst that was considered to celebrate the bicentenary, but it never happened. He's curious as to how close this came to actually happening and if the plan was to replace the Bathurst 1000 for that particular year or have it as an additional event.
Well, it was definitely to replace the 1000 for that year. I think it was actually first announced back in 1985, and Kenny's correct. It was entirely to celebrate the bicentenary. There were a lot of different things that were occurring that year. I think you could get government funding for bicentennial projects and various things.
Oh, there would have been heaps of that floating around.
Yeah, well, they would have needed a fair bit because I think what killed it in the end is the extra costs to not just race teams that would need to run a car and crew a car twice around the clock, but also having enough marshals and event officials to be able to sustain an event, never mind crowd control for crowds that were there would have to be trackside for 24 hours and all these additional costs that just didn't stack up. So I think they announced it in 85 and it was kiboshed in early 86. So,
and it's exactly the reason why every year the 12-hour is held, and there's always someone asking, why don't they make it a Bathurst 24-hour like the, you know, the 02-03 days? And all the reasons you've just listed there are exactly why it won't and it hasn't, because the sheer cost of people power, financial power, it's massive truckloads of money that are required. I think sometimes our fan base who love the sport so passionately and there's so many great things they'd love to see don't understand just how much money it costs to do a lot of these things. There's a lot of costs that you don't think about until you actually head on down the path. But no, Kenny, good stumbling, and you are absolutely right. It didn't happen, but at least a Bathurst 24-hour did happen at some point, but I'm not quite sure that the original concept involved a 7-litre Monaro. But anyway, that's a whole other topic. That's a whole other topic. Next one, Russell Newell. Depends where you come from on this one. Does an Australian Touring Car Championship still exist?
Well, it must do because I saw Brody Kostecki holding the trophy for it earlier this year.
Me too.
Yeah.
I was in the same room.
Yeah, one of the few motorsport-related appearances young Brody's had so far this year.
Probably just about the only one, I think. A Speedway and a Motorsport Australia Awards night. Russell, the Australian Touring Car Championship as an award from Motorsport Australia, which is obviously previously known as CAMS, does exist. Now, if you go searching on registered trademarks and business names, I think there's been a few cracks over the years at registering Australian Touring Car Championship as a brand or as a trademark.
Didn't Larry Perkins have it at one stage?
It's been said, but I'm not quite sure. I've had a look through the IP trademark files and I can't see a history of it, but that's not to say that it didn't happen. Of course, it's an interesting question that Russell mentions. Of course, the last time it was known as the Australian Touring Car Championship was 1998. Then when the endurance races were brought into the V8 Supercars title chase from 99, it became the Shell Championship Series. And then we've had a bunch of different titles and names, depending on who the championship sponsor was or wasn't, whether it was V8 Supercars or Supercars or Repco's in there or Virgin or
International V8 Supercars Championship
for a little while as well. But at the end of the day, I think the titles are relevant. It is the biggest game in town. No matter what it's called, it's the Premier Championship. MA still has the actual Australian Touring Car Championship, and they have continued to deem it awarded to whoever wins the Supercars Championship. So, yes, supercars of the current day are a long way away from touring cars in what would be deemed the glory days, but I think it's an important continuation of that award. And I guess there's a linking topic in recent times where we've seen the AASA jump on the Australian Drivers' Championship. In fact, they haven't registered that name themselves. They've actually leased it from another entity that has done that.
Now, oh, right.
Is it the Australian Drivers' Championship with those hyper races? It's not the same.
We had a couple of Sandown 500s without touring cars. So
I was okay with that. I'm fine with that. But when it's done in the way that it was done, when it's I mean, there were still top-level racing teams and cars competing in those Pro Car Sandown 500s. But with all due respect, Hyper Racers, it's a really interesting, cool little class that's cost-effective. But to be dubbed the Drivers Champion of Australia because of it is, well, it's a title, isn't it? But that's about it.
I think it suggests we should go get one.
I was going to say,
have a crack. And
we still wouldn't be the Australian Drivers Champions because we're no good, basically.
next question. It's from someone we know.
Oh.
C. Nalon.
Oh, that bloke. Yeah, I've seen him on the TV.
Yeah, yes. He asks, how many more of those V8 Utes memories has Noon's got stashed away in the vault?
Well, Chad is referring to some recent social media posting where we've been bowling out some cracker V8 Ute archive crashes, clashes, passes, in cars, all sorts of action pieces.
Hedgings
has been – oh, there was a good hedging from Sandown. If you haven't seen that on our Insta Reels, check that one out. That's gone – I think that's gone viral, in fact.
Yeah.
Chad and listeners, the answer is a truckload. We've got so much V8 Ute stuff coming out of our ears. A trayload, yeah, totally. Yep, dog on the back too. And we have got somewhere in the vicinity of 50, 60 hours – a V8 Ute racing vision. So the post-produced shows from the days when I was calling it, Chad started doing some of those in the latter part of the Channel 7 V8 Ute era, former category. I think we've talked about it on the pod, haven't we?
Yeah.
Along the journey. But for those who don't know, remember Craig Denyer, Billy West, they ran the V8 Ute series after it came away, I guess, from the collapsed Pro Car. The V8 Brutes was the original name. And obviously V8 Utes ended. There was boxes and boxes of the tapes, digital, you know, proper broadcast spec tapes.
High quality stuff.
Yeah, good stuff. And anyway, there was, long and the short of it, storage was limited. They needed a new home. They were gifted to us to use as we pleased, how we pleased, to share them with the fan base. And that's what we've done. I spent quite a bit of my own money to digitize those tapes to make them available to be able to be used. And now we're just going to roll them on out whenever we get time to bowl out some races on YouTube and some highlights and some low lights, depending on which car you're in.
depending on if you're the shunter or the shuntee.
Yeah, correct. So there is a truckload more to come. Rod Kinder's got the next question. He loves our episodes, says it here on my sheet. His question is, after Australia and New Zealand, which nationality has the most starts in the Australian Touring Car Championship / Supercars Championship?
So naturally, to answer this question, we turn to our resident data engineer, Shane Rogers.
We have a bit of news on him coming very soon.
Yes. So, I didn't actually get him to dig out the number for starts by Australian drivers and New Zealand drivers because naturally it'd be quite astronomical. But the next nationality-
I can't even guess.
I wouldn't have guessed the one it is.
Okay, shoot.
Brazil.
Max Wilson?
Max Wilson. 189 starts by Brazilian drivers, 178 of which are by Max.
Hang on. Give that to me again.
So, 189 race starts.
So, who's the other Brazilian?
Well, we had a few in the Gold Coast 600 days. Yeah.
Lucas Degrassi?
Lucas Degrassi. The late Gilles de Ferran.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. Drove with Jonathan Webb.
Yeah.
That was his final... Wasn't that his final race after he'd stopped sports car racing?
I think so. Yeah, because he'd pulled the pin Bruce on Jenkins, sports car racing prior to that.
No, yeah. He was the one, I think, that managed to... do some convincing to make that all happen. So, I would not have guessed that. I would not have guessed.
So, for the record, Brazil is P3. France is P4.
Alex Prema, surely.
Prema, 85, Muller. And Bourdais, 10, and yes, Muller as well.
Yeah.
Great Britain, fractionally behind their old rivals on 113.
There's been a few of those over
there. There has been a few. And, of course, combining England and Ireland and Scotland. Yep. And I don't know if we've had any Welsh drivers off the top of my head, but they'd be in with that as well.
No. And of course, Andy Prio doesn't count in that.
Well, statistically, he did.
Oh, did he? We counted him in that.
Yeah, because he's from the Isle of Guernsey, isn't he?
Yeah, is that part of Great Britain?
That's an excellent question that I was not prepared for.
I've got a feeling like it's its own thing. Anyway, it only raises in my mind because I just very recently listened to the Andy Prio Dinner with Racers podcast episode, which has been out for a while, but I struggled to get around to listening to podcasts very quickly, but that's why he was in my brain.
And Switzerland is next on 98.
Simona?
Simona with 91 of those.
Oh, who's the others?
That is an excellent question.
Oh, you didn't go dig that? Yeah, fair enough.
Answers on a postcard.
Answers on a postcard. What do we got next? Who's up?
John Hurry. Hi, guys. Love the pod. I'm loving all the extra motorsport content this year.
We have got a lot of extra. It's a very good point John's picked up here because we do have a lot more podcast content this year between the Motorsport News podcast, the BJR Rundown with Macaulay Jones. Brad occasionally saunters his way in and has a chat whenever he feels like it.
Gets his arm twisted, yes.
Yeah, I think he likes it twisted. the Rally Sport boys, Luke and Peter Witten with Special Stages Pod, Dust Trails kicking off, Ryko Rewinds looking back at some of the great stuff from history, Castrol Supercars Weekly. Tell you what, if you've got time to listen to any other motorsport podcast, you have seriously got way too much time on your hands. Anyway, what did John want to ask? Is he talking Mitsubishis?
He is, and he was a listener of the Ryko Rewind, especially the episode on the start of the Group A era from a few weeks ago.
Winter 95.
He heard about the Mitsubishi Starion and wondered when the last time a Mitsubishi was on the podium in an Australian Touring Car Championship round.
Take my comment from 7 seconds ago and replay it.
Yes.
That was the one and only. Winter 1985, Kevin Bartlett, KB at the wheel of the 66 Rally Art Mitsubishi Starion, third behind the two JPS BMs of Jimmy Richards and Neville Crichton. And that was it. A Starion never made it to the podium again in the championship, despite KB racing one, Brad Jones racing one for a time, Brian Sampson a privateer, but that was it, one and done.
It's funny how momentous that particular weekend was for various statistical things in the championship, I guess being like the start of a new era with the end of Group C and the start of Group A. First race and round win for a New Zealand driver.
JR.
First 1-2 in a race for New Zealand drivers.
Mm-hmm. With Crichton.
And
first BMW win.
Yes, correct. And up until about just over 12 months ago, the only race that didn't feature a Holden.
It was the only round.
Only round that didn't feature a Holden.
Because there was a couple of other rounds.
Oh, that was split races with like under 3 litre cars and
exactly.
Under so, 2 litres.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, otherwise, I'll have Shane Rogers all over me. Yes. He'll be all over me.
Every lap in under a minute means every second matters. Bosch Power Tools Perth Super Sprint, May 17 to 19. Book now at Ticketek. Supercars, unforgettable.
J Jordan Treloar is next up, and Jordan's familiar to us. He's done a bit of work with us at V8 Sleuth, spent some time up at Bathurst with the 1000 reporting for us a few years ago. He spent some time here in the office in recent times.
I think the last time I saw him was leaving Mount Panorama holding the rear slick off of Nathan Hearn's Trans Am car.
It was too. The 2021 Bathurst, the booming Bathurst of...
Mega Bathurst.
6 days, wasn't it? I think five, six. I don't know.
It was a lot.
Like about nine. Yeah. But after Nathan Hearn won the Trans Am title in the Dodge that he's recently pulled back out of the museum to race this year, he launched this big, huge, dirty burnout on the pit straight.
Which I think he got in trouble for.
I think he did, because he wasn't supposed to. But Jordan ended up with one of those tyres, and there he was lugging it over the bridge back to his car. Loves a bit of memorabilia. And he loves a good question. He's asked, what's the biggest year-on-year championship standings rise or fall for a full-time driver in supercars? And the thing that's triggered him is Will Davison. Remember that Will was the runner-up in 2009 for the Holden Racing Team, had a brilliant first-up year replacing Mark Scaife, won the two Enduros, won some other races, and then finished 22nd in a miserable, horrible 2010 that saw him leave the team at the end of the year. So he went down 20 spots. Are there any other drivers who've gone up or down the standings year on year to that level?
Well, ironically, Will Davison's feat is also runner-up in this list.
That's quite good, actually.
Yeah.
Nice segue, Lee.
So, actually, he's tied for second with Alan Gurr, who went... And this is looking at drivers who took part in every round of both seasons.
Full-time drivers.
So, not looking at guys who did Enduros 1 year and full-time the next or vice versa. Alan Gurr was 33rd in 2006 and 53rd in 2007. So, that's another drop of 20 positions.
There's a reason why.
Mm-hmm.
So, in 2007, he drove for Britec.
Yep.
He was in the Irwin Falcon, teammate to Jason Bright.
Mm-hmm.
2007 was the year that they limited the points to the top 15 finishers in each race.
Yes.
So, that meant that co-drivers in the endurance races who did well generally scored more points than a lot of drivers who drove full-time during the year, hence why he dropped so far.
Yes. And that's been responsible for a few things on both the down list and the up list.
So, who's the record of most movement?
The record of most movement with 21 positions down is Cameron McConville.
Oh.
06, 13th in 06 to 34th in 07.
So, again, that point structure change in 07 really did give us a couple of these answers.
Yeah. One that's fourth on this on the down list that's not responsible for the point structure change was Paul Radisich, 01 to 02. He had that cracking year in 2001 with DJR where he finished seventh in points, swept the Barbagallo round, won the Queensland 500 with Steve Johnson, all on Bridgestone tyres, and then they moved to Dunlops for 2002 and the cars just did not get on with them.
And they were still coming.
Yeah, 26th in 2002.
Oof.
But the biggest switch year on year is an improvement, and it's not a driver I would have expected, Anthony Tratt.
Okay, you're right. Not a driver I would have expected because has he been aided by the 07 thing?
No, he has not.
Oh, okay. Do tell.
So.
Well, he was out by then, wasn't he? He wasn't full time.
Yeah. So, a 37 position improvement.
Jeez.
63rd in 2000 to 26th in 2001.
How was he 63rd in 2000 as a full-time driver?
I guess he got beaten by a lot of drivers who just did Enduros.
Ah, you know why. Now I think about it. Oh, the points weren't even. They were weighted for different rounds. They were weighted for the big events. So, if he had a bomb at Bathurst, and I don't think he and Jonesy finished from memory.
No, they ran competitively, but then it all turned
anyone
south.
Anyone who was just doing the Enduros who scored well at Bathurst and Queensland would have blown him down the order. So, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Yes. And just to round this off, second on this list, Mark Winterbottom, 26 position improvement, 29th in 2005 to 3rd in 2006. And Andrew Jones, 20 position improvement, 44th in 2007 to 24th in 2008.
Yeah, so another one of those ones affected by that point season. Interesting that we've got the next question from Will Tricity, who asks about Alan Jones.
Yes.
Where does Alan Jones fit in the history as a touring car driver? He didn't win a championship, but he did win races and rounds. He was at match at times for Seaton, but he didn't win any endurance races of note. Thoughts?
The thing is, like, Jonesy's peak days as a driver, Like, when Alan Jones came into touring car racing full-time in the V8 era and the BMW era, he was, I don't want to say very old, but he was one of the older drivers in the category. So, his prime driving years were behind him by that point. All things considered, I think, I don't know what, I don't think he would fit based on performances up at the very top end of town against, like, your Brocks and your Johnsons and that. But he still was a very capable touring car driver.
He was a contender. He was always among it.
So on his day,
yeah,
when he felt like it,
yeah,
he could be phenomenally good.
That's where I was going with it. When you've won the Formula One World Championship and bailed on Formula One originally because you're sort of, done, go back to it, then do some other bits and pieces, I don't think it was his obsession and burning passion like it was for other blokes. To the level, I mean, not to say he wasn't caring or having a dip. I mean, the way he raced in some of those races, he was having a dip.
It seemed like he cared at Simmons in 93 when he sent Mark Scaife off the road on the exit of the hairpin.
He fully mailboxed him.
And like, then two corners later sent Gardner. Wayne Gardner.
He did contribute to two of the best towelings in one lap in championship history. In fact, within what, technically three corners. So, so he went full-time in 90. With B&H. I mean, he drove the Enduros with Bondi in 88.
He was racing the Alpha in 85
as well. He did the Alpha,
as well.
Before he went to the Haas F1 thing. In 89, he did Bathurst only, or whichever the Enduros
Bathurst
were
and Sandown.
In 89. Yeah. And then he was in the B&H cars full-time from 90 there last year with Sierra. So, I mean, Longhurst probably outpointed him on the whole in the BMWs. Then he went to Glenn Seaton's team right at the point when they had the – I mean, that was a masterstroke decision to move across to Seaton's team, who were the first exponents of the Falcon, a legal Falcon, to have it up and running. So, he was probably at his peak there. But I think this is a different conversation. I mean, second at Bathurst in 95, led early in 96 – one or two of those results swing the other way, and he's looked at very differently in his touring car career. It's almost like his touring car stuff is forgotten because the Formula One stuff is so dominant. But
that's a fair point. That car doesn't catch fire at Bathurst in 96. That is a very different race, because that car on pace, not far off the number one car that eventually went on to win, probably a stronger contender than what the 17 Johnson Bow car was at the same day.
Yeah, on Bridgestones.
Mm.
Could Alan Grice have matched it with Greg Murphy? Probably would have done near enough to the job required.
Keep him in the game, I mean, there were a lot of late safety cars in that race as well. So,
And then 97, I mean, after 96, AJ was done in touring cars, because in 97 it was a struggle for money at what was still Alan Jones Racing. He sells out of the team at the end of the year to the Stone Boys, who rebirthed as Stone Brothers Racing. He goes off and, well, he was going to do that. Remember that AJH Motorsport thing with Darren Pate in another car, and the backer turned out not to have the backing. He ends up running a second Tony Longhurst car with Komatsu. He ends up co-driving with Traddy, which by all reports was, you know, quite a great relationship. It worked out well. He got his final run with DJR alongside Greg Ritter in 02, had a couple of pretty good Enduros. But post-96, I mean, he just wasn't a factor in V8. So it's a really interesting discussion point, and it's a topic we could probably get a little bit more out. But we better move on. Jeff Bishop. Brock didn't like driving NASCAR to the point he never raced. That's true. He practiced a Thunderbird, but withdrew from the race.
I think he qualified or practiced instead.
I think it blew a few engines as well. He was happy that it blew engines just quietly. Mm. Bow wrecked at his attempt. Well, I think that was on a test day, wasn't it?
Yeah.
He was the first person who ever crashed at the Thunderdome.
Yes.
He did go good in Oscar when he had a crack in Falcons. But basically, the point of Jeff's question is, were there any other names that had a crack at NASCAR Oscar that have probably been forgotten over time?
You're going to enjoy this. Alan Jones.
He tested the same car. We've run those photos before on socials. The old, was it the 22 Bob Jane T-Marts Pontiac Grand Prix?
Yeah. And Jonesy also, well before this, I think before he was even Formula One world champion, he actually tested Richard Petty's NASCAR in the 70s. He had a couple of test laps in it. I can't remember whether it was like Atlanta or Daytona or somewhere, because he did the IROC series one year.
Okay, makes sense.
And I think he was fourth, or he was behind only NASCAR drivers and Mario Andretti, which is not too bad.
And Mario ever. Andretti.
Yeah, it was. So, yeah, AJ had a crack in one of those cars, but never, of course, never went on to race one. Win Percy also did
race. He raced.
He did race, yeah.
At the Thunderdome.
Yeah, he didn't. He qualified for the Christmas 500 in 88, but didn't take the start. I think he had engine issues as well. But he did race in the Moomba meeting the following year. Uh-huh. So, he did race.
The Moomba one's the one where Christopher Dean towered up that Commodore Oscar, wasn't it?
The one and same. The one that denied Larry Perkins an Oscar race start.
Well, didn't Larry drive like a... Oh, no. Dean drove a warm-up race or something
before the
main race, hence Larry didn't get to
Yeah. So, to Larry start. Qualified seventh, but DNS.
There is a reason why you are known in our office as the stock car sleuth, because this question is right up Will's alley. I'll throw a few in here. I think a lot of people have forgotten, when they think of bike races to go NASCAR, Kevin Schwantz comes to mind, probably because he did quite a few years in Australia. He did a little bit in the US, but he won on debut, I think, from memory at Oran Park, did he not?
He did.
Pepsi Lumina.
Yeah.
But I think everyone's forgotten that Wayne Gardner raced at Thunderdome in Terry Byers' second car and finished third. Was it Christmas 93 meeting?
Yeah. He talked about that on when he came on the V8 Sleuth podcast during COVID, although I think he had a couple of the details a bit skew if he remembered Terry Byers was involved, but I don't think he remembered that Terry was the owner of his car. But, yeah, you're right.
Mere detail.
That was actually meant to be a weekend where Wayne was racing and Schwantz was racing, but Lucky Strike Suzuki got wind of Kevin planning to run Ian Thomas's car and said, no, I don't think so, mate.
Was it the only time that Ian Thomas, who remember had the Tropic Coast Racing,
yes.
The Bright Eye Sunglasses cars, was it the first time he had a driver plan that didn't pan out? Because remember they did a deal for Jeff Brabham to become one of their drivers in late 96. But I think BMW again went, no. I think they may have said yes originally and then it changed from my memory to the point where it saw this situation where relief drivers in NASCAR are not new, that Brabham was allowed to take the start of the first race of the season, but he had to pit at the end of lap one, regardless of if it was yellow or green.
Get out
or get hoiked out. And they put Max Dumsney into the car, who John Sidney Racing was out of. Max was out of NASCAR. I think Kim Jane was driving for John by then. So he was three laps down or something before it even started. But, of course, under the rules of stock car racing, the driver that starts the race gets the points.
Yes.
But Brad was never back. So mentioning Schwantz, 34.
Yes.
That car that he raced later on, the 34 car, two people that spring into my mind straight away. Russell Ingall and Greg Murphy.
Oh, yes.
Russell Ingall, the winner at Bathurst of the 100K Saturday afternoon race in 98 at the 2-litre Bathurst.
Yep.
And then Murph drove that car. Had Murph driven that car before Russell, I think, from memory.
I think so, because didn't he punt Richo at AIR?
Yeah. I think we mentioned it on the pod with Murph. Isn't it funny? Because we've chatted to so many people now on our podcast over, 5 or 6 years, so many things we reference are, oh, yeah, he talked about it on the pod. Oh, yeah, I remember that now. Oh, I forgot I did that. But Murph, I remember being there at Thunderdome. I can't remember how many Thunderdome meetings he did. Maybe it was only one. But I was there for one of the ones, if not the one he did. And he was in the press conference with his eyes wide open, just bowling Days of Thunder lines out. He was just so bamboozled, amazed, excited. You don't see professional racing drivers very excited very often. Maybe if they win a big marquee race and they're, on the roof of a car or spraying champagne. He was frothing for an hour after this race. And he must have spent all night on the radio dropping Days of Thunder lines because we got them in the media conference afterwards.
That's great. I do have one additional driver to add to this list, Greg Hansford.
Oh, yeah.
Who did a lot more Oscar racing than I originally thought. So, when Jim Richards was prevented from taking part in Oscar or NASCAR races under his Nissan deal, Greg Hansford stepped into Mick Webb's number one Oscar and drove that for a season or two.
That was the yellow car, wasn't it?
The yellow EA, yeah.
But I think he'd also driven an XF there a couple of times.
I think might have been the Charlie O'Brien owned one. He also drove another EA as well, a white car.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah.
we're stock cast sleuthing hard today. And then there was the story, remember, that if you haven't heard the Charlie O'Brien sleuth pod that I did a few years ago, have a listen, because he and Greg were really close friends. He spoke really well about Greg and gave us some really beautiful insight. But the story of the Gold Coast Indy race where he got done out of a pile of cash.
Yeah.
Oh, well. Do you know how to find the right oil for your car? Now you can find out quickly and easily online, thanks to Castrol's Rego to Oil tool. Simply type in your Rego, select your state, and within seconds you'll know the best Castrol products to unlock the edge of performance in your car. So what's your car best suited to? Just search Rego, the number 2, and oil, and find out.
Will Tatnall asks, "Hi boys, got another Shazzy question for you. Would you guys happen to know what the GWR-193 Falcon is up to nowadays? My father used to be part of the Gary Wilmington team and thought you may be able to shed some light."
Good news, Will. It still exists, that green Falcon, which I think from memory was built out of a Group E production car.
Yeah, because the story I thought back in the day was that it was built from a taxi or a genuine road car, but I think you set me straight on that a long time ago.
Yeah, I think it was reported at the time to be a Group E, but it is owned by a private owner who we have been in touch with. I think you've dug out that we did a website story. Stefan Bartholomew might have done this a couple of years back.
Yeah, back in 2021, and it was in the process of being restored, given a very, very thorough restoration back then.
So, you know what? We're probably due to go and ask the owner and see if he's still got it and how he's traveling with that restoration job. Lee Durant, with the similarities between NASCAR and supercars slightly closing, has there been any interest from Toyota in possibly coming into the sport? He says that he knows supercars probably don't want another manufacturer right now because of the parity word, but it would be a big scoop to get a manufacturer like Toyota involved.
I think supercars would step over their own mother to get another manufacturer involved if money's coming in, yeah. I don't think it'll be Toyota, though. I don't think supercars is ever or motorsport in that form has ever fitted in with their marketing goals in Australia. They do a lot of rallying, of course, because there's a logical synergy between the various small cars that they've run, the Corollas, the Yaris's, and what they run in the Forests. But I don't think Toyota has hinted at any interest in joining supercars in this new era.
Or any era. They don't want to. They don't need to. No. It'll never, ever happen.
William Harradine asks, does supercars need to be a part of the Grand Prix weekend beyond this year?
No.
I don't know.
Need to be a part is the word that I'm honing in on, the need. Do they need to race at 5:50 on a Thursday afternoon that's not on free-to-air?
Do they need to have the corporate experience for their sponsors at a Grand Prix?
Do they need to do what they did in 2007 and be able to still have corporate experience with their drivers without having their cars at crazy times of racing and in places where people can't get to them?
Yeah, that's a bit rough. I think they do need to be there, but they're getting such a raw deal.
There's got to be, can't be like this. You've got to say it's over the line now. The pit lane that was made for them, they've been punted from.
Yeah.
And this all boils... And this is not a case of supercars should be the main headline act.
No.
Not the case.
No, no, no.
It's a Formula One Grand Prix. It's a world championship. It's always been Formula One. However, they've been knocked down the rung by the government. It's the Victorian government that are the ones to point the finger at here, because they were so paranoid that they were going to lose the Grand Prix to Sydney that they did a whatever you want deal with Liberty. And Liberty said, well, Formula 2 and Formula 3, sure. That's what's happened.
Yeah, that'll get people through the gates.
There is, and that's the thing. Whatever extra millions they've paid for that is not getting one single person through the gate. And it won't when the Drive to Survive fad dies down a bit. So, whatever length that contract that they've agreed to, and I'm not saying supercars are the be-all and end-all or that we're hammering the drum for supercars, but when you look at, as a business, I'm told that it's about $1 million supercars gets to go to the Grand Prix. Yes, it's great that there's their corporate partners. A lot of them are there with trackside suites and that type of thing. But I think that for all of the things that supercars racing is and where it's got away from in the eyes of the fans, is it for being for the fans? So here's a great opportunity for supercars to show who they're here for. So if you go to the Grand Prix now, again, or ongoing, does that feel like it's for the fans or for the corporates? The latter, I would say.
Yeah.
So if you say, no, we are going to go and do a deal to go and race at Winton. So there's a full weekend of TV coverage so our fans can get to a traditional regional venue to see our racing, which hasn't hosted the series for a little bit, which it's a test track still, remember. I would have thought that there'd be some, given that the Victorian government's spending money on events for regional areas of the state.
They love sending people to regional areas.
Absolutely. So they do it for live music. They do it for, I mean, as very soon in Ballarat, I know it well, there's a wrestling convention. I can't go, but I'd love to go. I mean, the Hitman Bret Hart's going to be there. But
That's honestly amazing.
It is. Yeah. Eric Bischoff, who used to run WCW, like some of the biggest names in professional wrestling are coming from America.
I can't believe that you can't be there.
Oh, go to a concert. I'm looking forward to the concert. It's going to be a great concert, but just the timing didn't work out. My point being, there's Victorian government funding for an event to bring attention and people to a regional area of Victoria.
Ironically, in the same way, for the same, largely the same reasons, we raced at Bathurst for round one this year.
Ding, ding. Exactly. You beat me to it. That's where I was going. Different state, but same theory. Mm. So I would like to see that. Do they need to be a part, William, of the Grand Prix? Yes, on the basis, though, that it's got a better return for the category and for the fans.
Rob Kingston, in 2016, when Penske came into supercars, there was talk that they had, quote, street circuit chassis and then separate chassis for other circuits. How many years did they use multiple chassis before having just the one per driver for all tracks?
I feel like there's a few elements being a little bit blurred here.
Mm.
I do recall when they came in 2015, of course, they were a single car team with, well, Marcus Ambrose and then Scott Pye when Marcus made the call to step back.
And they'd sleeved back from two cars the previous year.
Yeah, but they had run – they were in the process that their program was kind of car on, car off for – I don't think it was necessarily a street circuit car and a other car. It was more a case of run one car. So the car that Marcus drove at the Grand Prix – sorry, at Adelaide in Shell Helix colours – wasn't the same car that he drove at the Grand Prix in Shell Helix. Was it Shell Helix at the Grand Prix?
I think it was Worth Colours.
Worth Colours, that's right. So they had this kind of rotating policy of, so while you had one prepared for the next race, the other one would come back, get prepared, and a little bit NASCAR style, but I don't think it was a street circuit scenario specific. They really only did that for that first year, and then they went back to two cars when Scott Pye and Fabian Coulthard drove together. So really, it was only that first year from my memory. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I think they introduced, because they had existing chassis to start 2015. Then they introduced the first car with a DJR TP chassis number midway through the year.
That was at the end of 14 that Marcus drove as the Xbox wildcard.
That's right.
In Sydney.
And then that got totaled at Bathurst. So
slightly rearranged, I believe the term is. Carl Williams has a good question. Are Denny Hulme and Alan Jones the only Formula One world champions to race in the Bathurst 1000?
Oh, AJ's got a good run in this episode,
He's got a lot of mentions here.
They are not, but they are two out of three. The other one is Sir Jack Brabham.
Who wasn't Sir Jack at the time he raced in the Bathurst 1000.
No.
He was very much a three-time Formula One world champion.
Correct. Although he didn't quite get off the line in 76.
No. Went a bit better in 78, though.
Yes.
77. Better than 76, not as good as 78.
And drove with Jeff in 77.
In the Falcon.
In the Falcon. Yeah. John Goss's Falcon.
And it was in A9X Fordor in 78.
Yes.
And that was his last Bathurst 1000, wasn't it?
Yes.
Nice.
Luke Blattman, last question. Thoughts of Peter Brock's 1990 season? An Australian Touring Car Championship round win and a Bathurst win... an Australian Touring Car Championship win and Bathurst win that got away? He led a number of ATCC races and was a front runner at Bathurst. Tyres to blame.
I'd never really stopped to ponder this, but now that Luke mentions this, I think there's a great point here. So let's just strip it apart. Mm. Bathurst 1000, he's with Andy Rouse in the 05 Sierra, that Rouse crashes in the lead-up after he trips over Matt Wacker in the Murray Carter car in the S's. It's been a pretty well-replayed replay over the years.
Because Andy arrived right at the camera point.
Right in front of it. Could not have hidden any worse. then all day they're pitting for tyres constantly in the early stages. They're blistering. That was the year that the track had been resurfaced, was it not?
It was. And
since
only
the previous year's race.
And only Dunlop had arranged a test day in the lead up to the race.
Yeah.
Bridgestone hadn't, Yokohama hadn't either.
Aha. Uh-huh. So within what, 10 laps? Brock's in pit lane.
Somewhere in the first 10 to 15 laps.
Yeah, with blistered tyres. And multiple times that happened. They finally got the compound combination right and then poured on home, finished fourth a lap down.
They were fast and it was trouble-free for the rest of the race.
Yeah, so when you stop and think about it, of all the Brock wins that could have been the 10th, there's a pile of other ones that you could go, if, but, maybe. This one never really gets mentioned, but I think it's a big-time candidate.
A fair case, because you throw Brock into the mix of that late restart, if he's there with Grice, that's...
Oh, could you imagine that?
Yeah. Gricey in the factory Holden battling Brock in a non-factory Ford.
Who would have thought?
How strange.
And then in the championship, I mean, he was one of the four contenders going into the last round between Jim Richards, Colin Bond, Dick Johnson and PB. He had that win at Wanneroo. So the Mobil Sierra just came on strong in the back end of that year. Finished second at Oran Park, didn't he?
Yes, yeah.
Got smoked by Jim off the line. I think it cost him the $10 bet.
Yes, yeah.
But if you look back to the early couple of rounds, if one or two of those go okay rather than terrible, he's just about there.
Well, he nearly won at Simmons. It was only late in the race that Dick Johnson picked him off.
He faded with tyres, didn't he?
And this, the tyres are the thing again, because 1990 was the first year where we had any form of tyre, I don't want to say restriction, but you're prescribed what you should use.
Number.
So, yeah. You had to, before qualifying, choose two sets of tyres that you were going to use across qualifying and racing. So, you had to take a bit of an educated guess as to what compound you're going to go with. I can't remember if that was a legislative thing or whether that was a touring car.
Entrance group.
Thing. Yeah.
Mm.
But regardless, it was a thing. And I don't think Bridgestone were quite up with Dunlop and Yokohama by that point in the tyre battle.
Yeah. It took them until later in the year to really get zinging along. And remember that they sleeved back because it started with two cars with Brock and Andrew Medici. And a third car, the Brock Shop car,
Tony Noske,
on a couple of occasions. So they sort of sleeved back to just Brock's car for that second half of the title
after
Andrew had rolled it at Malala. But remember the Phillip Island had that multi-car crash on the opening lap and Brock ended up with the back end of his car walloped. And
he was the epicenter of it. He got turned around on the exit of Southern Loop.
Yeah, and then got ploughed into by someone. But the bit I remember is him going to the pits, getting repairs, steaming back out, with the camera cable from the pit lane camera wrapped around the car, dragging it around the track before he had to... I can't remember if it fell off or he came in and they took it off. But if you just turn that race into a couple of points, and I think Amaru, they struggled in the first round. Luke's got a really good point here of what could have been for Brock that year because of the 2 years in the Sierras. That was a pretty solid run. And he and Medici finished off the year winning the Nissan Mobil Series in New Zealand across Pukie, Wellington. And I think he went off on the first lap at Eastern Creek 500 and fought back to third by the end.
Yep.
Sandown, he finished second and fourth, which we've documented before.
Yeah.
So, he was there or thereabouts in all of those major races in the back end of the year. So, a season that could have been in so many aspects from that one. So, great question, Luke.
Yeah.
Keep him coming. That was really good stuff. And next week, we alluded to this a little earlier. For the first time in the history of the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Castrol, our stats man, our race engineer in the office, Shane Rogers, is going to make his debut. He's going to be with me next week. We are going to step through some of his favorite racing stats, some of the ones you've sent in over the journey, but we haven't had a chance to answer yet, and some more numerological gold, that's a technical description, to bring to the table. That's next week on the V8 Sleuth podcast. Will, you can have the week off.
Thank you.
And we will bring Shane into the chair next week to make his debut. He's just quietly, he's acting like he's all stressed, but I feel just quietly, he's ready to run.
I think he'll be fine when the lights go on.
Just try
and stop him. I think that's going to be the challenge.
We might have to bring a time limit into the next episode because he does love a stat and he does bring the info behind the stats. And he's the driving center of so much of the stuff that you hear on this podcast. So that's next week on the V8 Sleuth podcast. Keep listening. You've got to do us a favor. For all of our series partners who back the podcasts that we make, our website, buy their products, get their stuff, put Castrol in your engine, and find ways to tell Castrol that you're buying their products, because that helps us keep this stuff going. Free podcasts, website news, so much more. Back the people who back us, who create stuff for you. Right, we're done. I'm Aaron Noonan. He's Will Dale. We're done. Chat next week.
Every lap in under a minute means every second matters. Bosch Power Tools Perth Super Sprint, May 17 to 19. Book now at Ticketek. Supercars, unforgettable.